And good morning, and you are with yet another edition of One Land, Many Voices, your host this morning, as it is the case every fourth Friday here on KBOO at 9 a.m. with One Land, Many Voices. I'm Will Seaman, and with me is Hala Gores. Good morning.
Good morning, Will, and good morning to our listeners. This morning, we welcome your participation. If you'd like to call in with questions for our guests, please call 503-231-8187. Please try to keep your questions or comments on our topic this morning. Our guest this morning is Dr. Oren Ben-Dor, who grew up in Nahariya, Israel, and who is now a legal and political philosopher at the University of Southampton, UK, in England. He has been living in England for 20 years. His latest book, Thinking About Law, In Silence with Heidegger, has just been published with Hart Publishing, Oxford. He has contributed regularly to Counterpunch and the UK Independent Daily newspaper regarding Palestine and Israel. Good morning, Dr. Ben-Dor.
Oh, good evening from here.
Thank you for joining us. Dr. Ben-Dor, you have written that the core of the Jewish state of Israel is immoral. What do you mean by that?
The core of the Jewish state is immoral. This particular phrase connotes that there is a fundamental difference between the phrase of criticizing Israel, namely to say that the Israel state does this or that thing, when providing it doesn't do it, it can become a moral state like all others. That's what the premise of criticizing Israel means. But when you say that the core of Israel is immoral, what I mean to say that the very premise of statehood that Israel is established upon is essentially racist and inegalitarian, to be less inflamed phrase. And as such, we should say that we should criticize Israel for the morality of its statehood, with the implications that the state of Israel cannot continue to exist as it is configured at the moment, namely as a Jewish state. In other words, Israel has no right, no moral right, to exist as a Jewish state.
Professor Ben-Dor, this is Will Seaman. Thank you again for joining us this morning.
You're welcome.
This discussion of the right to exist as a Jewish state, I should mention to listeners that you have a recent article on the Counterpunch website on just this topic, and I'm wondering what prompted you to write this particular article, why Israel has no right to exist as a Jewish state, as we lead up to this the eve of the Annapolis meeting, the so-called the next peace summit. Why is it that you focused on this particular question?
Well, I think my role as an intellectual is to focus not on what is publicized, on what is said, but rather on what is not said, what is unsayable. So first of all, what is not said, and secondly, what is becoming unsayable or not being allowed to be mentioned. And I think one of the premises upon which the Annapolis meeting is based upon, as I put in the article, is that there are certain things that should not be mentioned, should not be on the cards to be talked on, should not be on the cards as issue for discussion. And one of the core things is, of course, is that Palestinians should recognize the right of Israel to exist as a Jewish state. That is something that is not for negotiations. Indeed, it's a premise for the existence of the talks at all. And I found it, after many, many reflections on this problem, is that how comes that the main issue that is the cause of the terrible things that Palestine has went through is precisely the things that nobody wants to talk about, nobody is allowing themselves to talk about. So it's become some kind of a sacred cow that is not about, is not allowed to be spoken about. So that's what prompted me. I want to bring into the discourse the notions that it's the very morality of the notion of the Jewish state, which is the cause of so much misery in all over historic Palestine. And I think as such, these things should come into the debate and being discussed, so as, first of all, people are aware, take it out of its concealment, so people are aware that this is a core issue that is actually the cause of so much of the misery of Palestinians, and I think, tragically, of Israelis as well, but then allow it, in the name of a moderate voice, to become an issue for negotiations with the hope that we can establish not a Jewish state in Palestine, but one egalitarian state in which citizen equality of citizen prevails.
I wonder, I think many of our folks listening have a very concrete idea about the ways in which Israel's being a Jewish state has meant discrimination against Israel's non-Jewish citizens. But I think also that for many, it's still a bit abstract. The focus has been primarily on the crimes of the occupation, the West Bank and Gaza.
Sure.
Can you talk maybe about some concrete examples of discrimination that's embodied in the laws and institutions of the State of Israel?
Yeah, sure. Well, first of all, let's start with the very notions that we can divide the wrong that afflicted the historic Palestine into broadly three wrongs. One is the occupations of the occupied territories in 1967. But focusing on that issue actually hides from the fact that all the states of Israel came into existence by ethnically cleanse all most of the indigenous populations, three quarters of a million of the indigenous populations, in order to establish the possibility of a state with a Jewish majority and character. So first of all, there is a well-documented by eminent historians like Ilan Pape, the very notions that Israel was created through ethnic cleansing, and but for this ethnic cleansing, we would have no actually physical possibility of having a state with Jewish majority. Now, some non-Jewish Arabs, I'm saying non-Jewish Arabs because there are Arab Jews in Israel, but some non-Jewish Arabs, part of the indigenous populations, stayed in Palestine and were not ethnically cleansed. And these people suffer two wrongs. We usually dub them Israeli Arabs. These people suffer two wrongs. The first wrong was that many of them have been actually internally displaced within the state of Israel, becoming part of a host village and never been allowed to go back to their original villages. So not only Israel, for obvious reason, didn't allow the refugees, the three quarters of a million, to come back, it also internally displaced many, many thousands of people from their villages and never allowed them to come back. Actually, what they did with the villages is, through its laws, it declared many of the properties of the villages to be absentees' properties, which could then transfer to a special custodian of absentee properties, who then relinquished them back, you know, for Jewish settlements within the state of Israel. So part of the internal displacement was a certain tactic for Judaizing the land of Israel. But lastly, those who were not displaced are still have to be citizens, non-Jewish citizens, non-Jewish Arab citizens, in a state that completely channels its immigration laws, its education investments, its general economic investments for the sake of Jews more than for the sake of its Arab sectors. So the state of Israel is a Jewish state, and as such as it exists, firstly, for the sake of Jews. Concrete example of the way the Israeli Arabs will be discriminated is, of course, the immigration policy. You know, if you are a Jew, that means anywhere in the world, that means that you and your children and all your family can become automatically, as of right, citizens of the State of Israel. This is not something that is open to Palestinian Arab or Israeli Arab that lives in Israel. And even further than that, I mean, the whole way in which the Israeli-Palestinian people are being seen, both instrumentally and symbolically, is as enemy within, as a demographic threat. Anything that can be done in order to encourage a certain birth rate that will slow their demographic threat. Anything that can be done in order to make their life less worthy is encouraged. They are essentially seen as a potential risk from within of the Jewish state. The other concrete example is that they are given the vote in the seemingly democratic State of Israel, but in fact there could never be an Arab prime minister in Israel. It's not a possibility. If there is a coalition in Israel, as we know, it's a proportional representation system. So if there is a coalition which is formed, there will never be an Arab party which is part of the coalition, because the argument is that the State of Israel, the fate of the State of Israel, cannot be determined on the whims of two Arab members of parliament. So in fact there are a lot of ways in which Arabs are given certain bundle of rights. The Arab Israelis are given certain bundle of rights, but this bundle of rights is not as superior, is not as good as those Jewish people who are the citizens of Israel, and hence the discrimination. So the broad discrimination against Palestinians in the three groups is the occupation of the whole of historic Palestine, and more specifically of the occupied territories. Secondly, the dispossession and the ethnic cleansing, and never allowed those refugees to return to their villages. And the third thing is the actual discrimination that will affect anybody who lives under a state that exists primarily for the sake of, not for the sake, but for the sake of its Jewish citizens.
Professor Ben-Dor, why don't we take a caller now? Go ahead, caller, you're on.
Yes, hello. I know you want to be on an intellectual level. I want to say, I hope I don't cry. I want to say to you, and to all the people in the world that are working against evil and unhealth in the world, I want to thank you and send blessings to all of you. Thank you.
Thank you, caller.
Thank you very much, caller. And Mr. Ben-Dor, I wonder if we could talk a little bit about a phrase in one of your articles that really was very striking to me. And that was, you refer to racist policymaking by the legislature, the Knesset, I'm assuming you're referring to, and a racist constitutional interpretation by the Supreme Court.
Yeah.
And this is, of course, something that is often, time and again, brought to our attention here, especially in the United States. I don't know how much you monitor the U.S. media.
Uh-huh.
But that Israel is alone a democracy, and it has these institutions that, of course, we see as correlates to the institutions in the United States. Can you talk about what you were referring to in terms of racist policy? Yes.
Of course. The normal constitution establish itself as a moral premise which protects the people who are under this constitution. And one of the basic premise of separations of power in a constitution is that legislatures make certain policies because they have a certain goals for their communities. And then there is a court that can hold this legislature to book. In other words, if a legislature oppresses certain fundamental human rights or abuses its powers, then the courts can, in the name of these rights, discriminate political questions in a certain way that holds the legislatures to book. So there is a basic fundamental constitution that enshrines liberty and equality to all the citizens of the polity, And then it has its institutional expression through legislature and courts to protect that. Now, in Israel, there is a fundamental, because the state is defined as a Jewish state, there is a fundamental defect in the way its constitution is pre-configured. On the one hand, this constitution tries to be democratic, but at the same time, it has a higher commitment, and I emphasize a higher commitment because we are talking about priority here, to the notions of it being a Jewish state. The principles of democracy and the principles of equality of citizenship cannot be protected by the Supreme Court so as to say that the very notions of Jewish state is itself incompatible with the notions of democracy and the notions of equality of citizenship for all the reasons I said. So the legislature, in fact, is getting a free rein to abuse its power to enact all these laws that either operate to further Judaization of the land or to entrench either directly or by delegation certain schemes for discrimination. And the Supreme Court is actually cannot questions what they do, because the fundamental principle of constitutional interpretation is that it has to be a Jewish democratic state and not a democratic state. So the notions of Jewishness of the state take primacy over all the basic values that I'm sure many of you in the States hold very dear. Can you imagine that, for example, the Supreme Court of the United States is constrained in its interpretations of the First Amendment, as long as it doesn't impair the Christian nature of the state? This is something that is unheard of, and therefore the whole racist laws from the Jewish right to return to Palestine and to laws that actually discriminate against Palestinians, there is a complete constitutional mispriorities. It's something that is completely entrenched for the sake of the Jewishness of the state. So we are talking about priority here and constraint, equality and liberty taking less priority, or they are less important than the Jewishness of the state. And if this is not racism, what is?
Professor Bendor, why don't we go ahead and take another call? Go ahead,
sure.
Caller.
Is that me?
Yes, it is.
The professor mentioned Ilan Pappe, and on the website gopbias.org, there is a synopsis of what he said in the Netherlands in June of this year. My question is, the Jewish flag is the Star of David. Is Israel a theocracy in the general, what we might think of a theocracy as being?
I think that Israel, thank you very much for your question. I think that Israel is an ethnocracy, if anything. It's a state that assign a different stake, different powers, and different priority, and different ownership of the state to any person who passed a certain test of Jewishness. It's very difficult to label it either, actually, ethnocracy or theocracy, because this test can be an ethnic test, it can be a religious test, or it could be a certain test of a certain collective memory that you subscribe to in that state. What constitutes Jewish is a central problem in Israel, and it's a constantly inventing consensus around this question. But the test itself, and as I said again in the article of Counterpunch, is that the actual test is not important. The very fact that passing a certain test gives you a preferential stake in the polity is a racist premise. And it doesn't matter how you label it. Can you imagine again in the state that passing a certain test of identity will give you a completely different bundle of rights that will enshrine occupation, dispossessions, and discrimination against other people? Probably you wouldn't imagine something like that happening. So injustices exist everywhere. That's a matter of course. But in Israel, there is this premise that prevents the address of injustices and just rectifications of them in perpetuity, because the state is defined as giving preferential stake for Jews. I hope it answers your question.
Thank you. Professor, some Arab Knesset members have attempted to deal with this issue by arguing that they should not have to salute the Israeli flag, that it is not their flag, that among other things. Can you, you're familiar with that situation, of course.
Of course, yeah.
Can you explain to our listeners what is happening in that regard?
Well, you see, I mean, this is the impossible predicament. I mean, can you see what predicaments, on the one hand, what a nauseating predicament a non-Jew Arab who lives in Israel faces. On the one hand, the political participation, any sense of in which lip service of affecting other people is giving to this person, would be to be a member of the Israeli parliament, of the Knesset. But in order to be such a parliament, a member of parliament, they have to swear the alliance to a state that completely discriminates against them by the very premise of its statehood. A state that completely internally displaces them. And so you can see there are versions of what they do. So they're doing a lot of, they refuse to do it, they refuse to align. There have been a lot of fuss about it, but you can see their predicament. The predicament is that my identity as a Palestinian is incompatible with these notions of a second-class Israeli Arab. In the same way, the Jewish democratic notion is oxymoron, also the notions of an Israeli Arab is. And an Israeli Arab means a second-class citizen, and nevertheless who are given the lip service participations in the legislatures. So the concealment is complete, and that's what's so nauseating about it.
And we're speaking with Dr. Oren Ben-Dor, a legal and political philosopher at the University of Southampton in the United Kingdom. Dr. Ben-Dor was born in Nahariya in northern Israel, but left Israel as a young man, has been living in England for the last 20 years. We're talking about a variety of topics this morning. I want to mention a couple of events that are coming up, just to make sure that we don't forget to mention these very important events. Thursday, November 29th, from 12 to 1:30 p.m., Pakistan, Its People and Future, with Speaker Ethan Casey, author-journalist. This is at the University Club, 1225 Southwest 6th Avenue, sponsored by the World Affairs Council of Oregon. That, again, is November 29th, Thursday, for a very timely presentation, Pakistan, Its People and Future. And then on Friday, November 30th at 7 p.m., Iran Forum, The Real Story Behind U.S. Policy Towards Iran. Speakers Reese Ehrlich, author, investigative journalist, and recent political prisoner in Iran, Ali Shakiri, a recent political prisoner. This is at the First Unitarian Church, Salmon Street Sanctuary, Southwest 12th and Salmon Street here in Portland, and that is co-sponsored by the American-Iranian Friendship Council, the Portland Alliance, KGBU, and many other groups. We have a caller on the phone, but I'm going to ask our caller to be patient, because I want to ask our guest, Dr. Ben-Dor, about his discussion of pragmatism in his recent article. And Dr. Ben-Dor, you talk about two kinds of pragmatism, and you say we need the kind of pragmatism that responds to the challenge of inequality, but you talk about another kind of pragmatism, a kind that entrenches inequality. Could you talk about how this word, this notion of being practical with regard to finding a solution, a path to peace in this conflict, what is it, how is that word being used?
All right. The notions of pragmatism has been abused to say that the state of Israel now exists, and therefore its existence should be pragmatically recognized. It will be a topic to try to reform that state, and therefore it makes no sense to expose the very statehood of the state to moral criticism as a pragmatic argument. So saying there are injustices in the world, and pragmatism has to recognize that, and therefore we should put up, and perhaps even as reasonable, the existence of a state that is not absolutely democratic, has certain blemishes, but pragmatically that's something that we have to do. And I argued in this article that this use of pragmatism is unacceptable. It's actually abusive of the notion. A certain use which will be almost amount to saying that because it's highly inconvenient and seems highly impractical to reform apartheid in South Africa, we should let some form of apartheid be accepted as practical and reasonable. And I think this is not on, this is an abuse of the notion. And I'm trying to distinguish it from a very acceptable notion of pragmatism, which recognizing that, however unjustly, there are now 6 million Jews there, and you have to make sure that you rectify past injustices by not causing further injustices to the people who are currently there. So the equality, flourishing, and good life and welfare of the Jewish people who are currently there should be the prime considerations of any solutions to historic Palestine. But that doesn't mean to say that we should not open the very premise of the statehood to questions because of pragmatism. After opening this question, after seeing that the Israeli state is a racist state, or rather a state that is based on a racist premise, then we can start thinking about how do we subject, I beg your pardon, how do we subject all of Palestine to individuated claim for truth and reconciliation that will both ensure that people who were dispossessed and were expelled from there can either return and settle there, or if it is absolutely not possible, to allow them alternative places of settlement. And if they choose not to, and I emphasize if they choose not to, then they can be offered some form of compensation. That is getting your hand dirty. That is what I called pragmatism, how to rectify historical injustices without causing others. Now, that is a challenge, but this is a very different challenge than saying that we have to give this state, this premise of this state, a carte blanche, and not opening to moral and ethical challenge.
Professor, let's take another call. Go ahead, caller.
Sure.
Thank you.
Good morning, and thank you, Doctor, for this show. Thanks, Will, too. This Jeff in North Portland with a question about secularism, and I'm wondering, is it possible in any situation within Greater Palestine for secularism to come to the fore? And I'm also wondering, I have always, oddly enough, been a one-state solution kind of fellow, and I believe that this pragmatism you speak of. Thanks for exposing that, Doctor. And we're going into Annapolis with this presumption of a two-state solution, as we call it. But what hope is there of secular leadership and secular democracy, either on the part of the adherence to Islam, the adherence to Judaism? Is there a chance for secular democracy? And is one state really the solution? I'll take my answer off there. Thank you so much.
Thank you for your questions. First of all, the notions of, and I'm grateful for you to mention it, the notion of two-state solution is often wrapped as a pragmatic solution. And that is what I'm trying, and I hope it is clear by now, to demolish. It's in fact a recipe for legitimations of the Jewish state. That's what the two-state solution is. And it's for a legitimation for the right of Israel to exist as a Jewish state and racist as such. Now to your questions about what chances are for a secular society. I think that there is an egalitarian ethos in Israel. And that's why I think we are bothering with that. I think that there is a worth, Israel seems to raise certain humanists in them. If you take David Grossman, Amos Oz, they seem to me to be greatest humanists in their pretensions, but in fact, as far as it comes to the racist nature of the state, they become racist themselves. There is a no-go area for them. But the point I want to emphasize is that I think that although whether you are a left-wing or a right-wing in Israel, you are a racist because you still promote the notions of a Jewish state in one form or another, there is an egalitarian ethos there that I think people start to be more aware that the two-state solution doesn't work. It doesn't address the real pain of people over there. It raises and breeds hatreds and victimhood. And what I hope, speaking about chances is always a talk about hope, and there is no hope without fear, as Spinoza taught us, is that this egalitarian ethos can somehow develop into a political movement that will may probably be outside Israel, maybe grow in exile, something very akin to the ANC in South Africa. We might call it the Palestine National Congress, that will consist of certain ex-Israelis and Palestinians who are promoting the cause of inequality. And my hope, the chances, I don't think that there is any chance of such a movement coming from within Israel. Israel is very much embedded in victimhood and in hatred, in a circle of hatred. In fact, it nourishes violence to promote its victim mentality. But outside Israel, I hope that the rest of the world will see the fallacy that it tries to protect all the time. And I hope that there will be a snowball that will grow to realizing this fallacy. And eventually there will be sufficient momentum, if not in Israel, but in the outside world, to impose that, first of all, to establish a certain political movement, but also the will to impose a certain form of sanctions on the state, not as a punishment, but as a form of communications for a moral transformations of the situations within Palestine. I don't think that the circle of hatred and violence will be reformed from within, but I'm very, very hopeful that the same world that resists apartheid can form the consensus and will to reform the situations in Palestine, and eventually will also awaken the egalitarian ethos, however the very lame duck one, but the egalitarian ethos that exists inside it.
You're listening to One Land, Many Voices, and you're tuned to KBOO, listener-sponsored community radio, 90.7 FM in Portland, 100.7 FM in Corvallis, and 91.9 FM in the Columbia Gorge. This is also available as streaming audio at KBOO's website at www.kboo.org. Professor, let me follow up on this notion that Israel nourishes violence. What do you mean by that?
I mean that whenever there is a certain chance of stability, Israel can fear the exposure of the terrible contradiction and denial that it is based on, the denials of the fact that it came about by ethnic cleansing, and that its very existence perpetuates discriminations and second-class people that it oppresses. Whenever there is stability, Israel becoming endangered in that. There are dangers that the unity will be dissolved. There is a certain need for impetus for unification. And the only thing that can, the only thing that sadly Israelis could be united behind is their victim consciousness, a victim consciousness that I grew up on. By the way, for your viewers, I think it would be beneficial to know that my father is a Holocaust survivor. His family were murdered in Auschwitz and died in Buchenwald. But the thing is that we were raised on this victim mentality that all the world is against us. And when in times of stability, this victim mentality that is such a unifying force in Israel is under threat. And whenever there is a sufficient glimpse for a solution with the Palestinians, then immediately there is a threat of the exposure of this denial. And I think that's why Israel needs violence. Israel needs instability and provocation in order to create that consciousness that doesn't question anymore, that lives in denial. So I think there is something that is self-nourishing. In Israel, the unifications will be maintained by not making the two-state solutions happen, because if you allow this two-state solution to happen, then it will be obvious that there will be groups that are completely discriminated by it, such as the Israeli Arabs and the refugees who are not allowed to return. But also Israel, for obvious reasons, won't allow for a single state, because this will call for the diminishing of its Jewish premise. So Israel really benefits from the failure of doing either two states or one state. It tries to maintain these constant oscillations between these two and constant failure of both. And one of the ways to do it is to nourish violence. So first, by violence, you unify through the victim consciousness all people from all political persuasions in Israel. And secondly, you keep oscillating between the failure of the two states and the impossibility or inconceivability of the one state. If you take David Grossman, for example, who is Israel's great rationalizer, as I see it, in times of crisis, in times of violence, he follows and he sings the songs and he says, there is no choice. It's a very famous expression in Israel. There is no choice. If we want a Jewish state, we have to destroy, for example, Lebanon. So Israel reacts quite improportionally to things. You know, it kidnapped some of its soldiers, but it reacted by destroying the whole country. But it justified it as, because everybody wants to destroy us, because we have this victim mentality, there is no choice, and we have to do it. So that's how violence becomes a service in the consciousness of Israelis.
I want to remind our listeners that if they'd like to take part in this discussion this morning, they can call KABU at 503-231-8187. That's 503-231-8187 if you'd like to pose a question or make a comment about topics this morning. Dr. Ben-Dor, you talked about growing up in Israel and being essentially brought up within this kind of ideology, this indoctrination of victimhood. How do you suppose you found a way out of it? How did you develop a critical perspective on that ideology?
I haven't been in Israel for 20 years, and I was in the so-called left wing in Israel for many years when I was there, and I went to a lot of demonstrations about it. But when you are outside it, and when you suddenly see that things don't work out, you are gradually transformed, and your views are transformed. You suddenly don't need to demonize and symbolically oppress the Arab. If you know, I have many Arab friends, and I grew out of it. But one of the things that really changed me, apart from reading about it and apart from being outside Israel, was in 2000, the second Intifada, when it broke out, there was a lot of violence that has been used against Israeli Arabs. In fact, a lot of Israeli Arabs were wounded or killed. One particular story that I think had a huge moral transformation on me was that Israeli troops came and killed Hassan Asleh, who was a peace demonstrator in the Galilee, and brutally murdered him just for being there. And I remember reading about the case, and you suddenly see that the conflict is not between a state of Israel and another abstract entity called the Palestinians, but it is actually a live conflict that affects the very people who live in the state of Israel. And trying to come to terms with that made me realize that there is certain violence, the same thing that I talked about violence in my previous question, also is generated against Israeli Arabs, a constant provocations of them, a constant trying to make them the enemy within and to be violent towards them, to keep their separation from the Jewish populations what has sometimes been referred to as the glass wall between Arab citizens and Jewish citizens, Arab non-Jew citizens and Jewish citizens. So I came to see that there is a fundamental thing that is wrong with the whole premise. And of course at that time I thought about the right of return of Palestinians, but I still didn't conceptualize it, or my consciousness didn't allow me to conceptualize it as the fact that there is no Palestinian return, the fact that there is discrimination against Palestinian Arabs, is all related to the need to conceal and to protect the very notions of a Jewish state. And it took many years for me to realize that, and I think I want to use my realizations of it and share it with people to the best degree possible, so we can save lives and we can save from this region from bloodshed.
We want to thank our listeners when they call in for being patient. Our next caller is on. Go ahead, please. You're on.
Hello.
Yes.
Yes. I've been listening since the beginning of the show, and I'm an American Jew, and I am predisposed to be very aware and very upset at the state of Israel and what's going on. However, what I'm hearing from Dr. Ben-Dor are a series of statements that I...
Have we lost our caller?
Hello?
Yes, go ahead.
Hello there.
I'm saying that I think that a number of the statements that Dr. Ben-Dor has made are incredibly naive. They offer no solutions. He says Israel benefits in maintaining one state. Israel benefits in maintaining two states. It talks about a chance for secular society. There are no secular societies that I know of that are in existence in the Middle East. And then he makes comparison to the United States, asking us to imagine that laws could be passed to advance a Christian state, when in fact in the United States of America that's exactly what's going on. This is not a secular nation any longer. There is this push towards Christian views. And then going back to the connection to the United States in terms of the United States was also based on ethnic cleansing. We came in and cleansed the indigenous peoples and formed our own country here. So I just think it's naive, talking about a circle of hatred. That happens not just with the Israelis and the Palestinians, but with the various groups in Iraq and all over the Middle East. So I guess what I want to hear is a proposed solution.
Caller, those are some terrific questions. Can you please hold on? Let's let our guest respond. You asked a number of very good questions, but hang on, and we'll give you a chance to follow up. Dr. Ben-Dor, would you like to respond to some of the questions raised by our caller?
Yeah, sure. I'll respond. I'm grateful for these very important questions. I didn't say that there is no preparation for one state or two states in Israel. I simply think that Israel benefits from a non-solution, and it oscillates hopelessly between the injustice of the two-state solutions and impossibility to conceive a one-state one. And it's quite beneficial that we keep the situation oscillating and benefiting Israel. But more to the response of your guest's questions, I think that to take the last point first, the fact that many countries of the world were established by ethnic cleansing, the notions of colonialism, is very well known. And what makes Israel apart is that there is no constitutional framework to gradually undo colonialism and to try, in, as what I said, is an acceptable, pragmatic way, to decolonize the country. There is a constitutional framework which will actually hamper decolonization because the state is defined as a Jewish state. So the question is not the act of ethnic cleansing, because a lot of states came about like that, and I'm sure you are right. but it's actually the premise that prevents us from undoing the colonizations. However imperfectly and however pragmatically, there is something that we simply cannot question. To the questions that other states are in the Middle East, and they are all religious states. Of course they are, but Israel claims to be a democracy, and I think that this is one of the fallacies that I want to expose. I think there are many injustices in the world, there are many theocracies, and I will be the last person to defend any of those many cases of injustice. I'm pointing out to a particular hypocrisy that concerns the issue of Palestine, and that I would hope that in the case of Palestine we can establish, I wouldn't call it a secular, but an egalitarian and non-sectarian state in which all religions could live under equality of citizenship. Palestine is a place that is sacred for all religions, and there is no particular reasons why it should belong to Jews only, and to belong them in a constitutional preference. And again, this relates to the point that you said the U.S. is a Christian country, or the U.K. is a Christian country. I think that you fail to distinguish between the fact that there is in every society a dominant religion, and nobody denies that. That's a matter of de facto. But when this domination, or when this dominance of religion, or a dominant religion, is translated into injustice, is where this religion is again translated through the constitutional and legal structure to give preferential stake, which is constitutionally defended as against other people of other religions. It's not the fact that I'm not criticizing any society for having a dominant religion in it. I even not criticizing any society for having injustices in it. Injustices exist everywhere. Of course they do. But there is always, one would hope, a constitutional framework which is based on liberty and equality, which poses a critical ethical challenge to these injustices and can reform them. This is precisely what is absent in the state of Israel, because the state itself is defined as a Jewish state.
Caller, yes. You want to follow up?
And I hope it answers your question.
I certainly think it answers the main question, but except for the
caller, try that again, please.
I think it answers the underlying notion of what I was asking, but what ultimately it doesn't do, you know, in a practical way, is create a solution. I'm not hearing, okay, what can we do now?
Okay, what can we do now is like that. First of all, we have to take the heat out of the conflict. And to take the heat out of the conflict, we have to first of all acknowledge what the injustice in operations here. As I said in the article, Israel has to apologize for what it does in ethnically cleansing the country and coming to being by that. Just doing that and apologize for that will do too much, will do so much, unbelievable so much. But of course this is hardly sufficient. Israel should reconfigure itself to become one state for all the citizens that will live in there, under equality, and this means that it loses a state that will be in preferential stake for Jews. The right of return, the automatic right of return of Jewish people to Israel will become subject to an equality principle in which all the members of the polity of Israel will decide immigration criteria. Israel could remain the national home for the Jewish people, but not on the basis of giving them any preferential stake. It will allow a proper return of the Palestinian refugees. It will enshrine the rights of the minority Jewish people, because Jewish people, if we allow for a proper return, there are all the possibilities that Jewish people will become a significant minority in the one egalitarian state and will have to enshrine their rights. But the thing is, for a nothing short of a legal revolution, which will jettison the premise of a Jewish state, and will enshrine one egalitarian state over whole of Palestine, which will encompass what is now the state of Israel and the occupied territories, under which everybody will be living in equality of citizenship, acknowledging that historic Palestine belongs to everybody that lives there equally.
Well, I agree with you on a philosophical level. I absolutely do. Practically speaking, I don't know. I don't see it.
Caller,
thank you for speaking with me.
People didn't see also the reform of apartheid as possible. I think there is always, as I said, I don't think it will start from the state of Israel, but I think this call, this manifesto, for establishing one state solution, if it will become political movement outside Israel, if it become hosted by a state, hopefully South Africa, which can form an example of how these things can be done, then I think it will be source of inspiration, not only to Israel, who are completely brainwashed, but to all the world. And from there on, I don't have a magic prognosis, but I think if we don't do that, then we will continue to fool ourselves that we are achieving some pragmatic solutions, while all we are doing is entrenching the pain of people, becoming even more entrenched, and therefore require even more violence to resist.
Thank you very much, caller. We do have one more caller online. We'd like to go to that caller. Caller, you're on the air now.
Hi. I do believe that the idea that there is no solution or not reaching a solution benefits Israel. And the one thing that, and the United States as well, and the one thing that seems to come up all the time is that we're not going to talk to Hamas. And maybe I give my administration too much credit, but I really believe that they know that they need to talk to Hamas, but they're not, because they know that, you know, that would actually lead to a solution. Now, my specific question is, I was listening to National Public Radio the other day, and Linda Gladstein made a blanket statement that Hamas does not want a peace treaty with Israel. Is that true?
Dr. Ben-Dor.
Okay, yeah. shall I respond?
Yes, please.
Yes. When Hamas was elected, I was really, if you like, inflated with hope. And I wrote an article to Counterpunch on the day Hamas victory, a new hope, question mark. And the reason is that the Palestinian leadership itself has become quite corrupted, and if you use a horrible expression, Zionized, in the way that, again, it has already, for reasons of corruption, accept the right of the Jewish state to exist. At least that's what it does all the time. Now, I think that after years of silencing the core cause of immorality, I can understand why methods of resistance has become enormously violent and desperate. You know, people kill themselves and their enemies in order to smirch a point that is not allowed to be surfaced otherwise. So, the association of Hamas with suicide bombers is something that we need to contemplate very seriously, why these suicide bombers occurred. But speaking as a political movement, is Hamas is actually the only, if you like, a Palestinian body that doesn't recognize the right of Israel to exist. It also has, besides of this very good political agenda, it has an Islamic agenda. And as such, this is an agenda that I personally do not approve, you know, because the same reasons that prevents me from following and adopting the notion of a Jewish state prevents me from recognizing an Islamic state. So by talking to Hamas, by containing it, you actually make Hamas life much more difficult, because you can then press them to separate the very acceptable political agenda, namely the fight against Zionism and against the notion of the Jewish state and the immorality of it, from their Islamic agenda, which is highly unacceptable. When you reject Hamas, when you completely don't bring them within the debate, within the discourse, you allow them the possibility to continue to unite their Islamic and their political agenda. And that's why I think the Hamas election was a sign that the Palestinian people are desperate, not only with their leadership, but gave the vote to the only body that can address their pain and their dispossession and discrimination. But at that point, there was a possibility that sadly is being missed by gangsterizing it as a terrorist organization and not talking to them. Actually, after Hamas was elected, there was an article in the British Guardian by Khaled Mashal, who was Hamas' political leader, whose Israel tried to assassinate a few times, that you couldn't read a more tolerant treatise than that. He said that Muslims have never been anything against Jews, but they will not succumb to the Zionist premise. It was a very encouraging, and if you can find it on the website, I would strongly encourage you to look at this very article. But there, you know, in every risk, and in very act of desperation, there is also an opportunity. And the world chose to protect Israel's right to exist to such an extent that it didn't include Hamas in even talking.
And Professor Ben-Nor, we are coming to the end of our hour. Thank you for joining One Land, Many Voices from England. We appreciate your insight and taking our callers' questions.
And those articles that were mentioned, the articles by Dr. Ben-Nor, our guest, are available at the Counterpunch website. We'll try to link to those from the pdxjustice.org website as well. If you'd like to write to us at One Land, Many Voices, write to us at pdxjustice@riseup.net. Dr. Ben-Nor, thank you so much for joining us this morning.
You're welcome.
And that brings us to the end of another edition of One Land, Many Voices.